the Leaders of Maybridge. Thanks for joining us today, especially if you're just checking us out. And we're doing a little four-week series to coincide with being able to meet again in person, although I hope this message will still connect even if you're joining us online. This is part three of our series. We've done sadness to lament, then lament to hope, and now it's hope to joy. Hope must become joy. So today is all about joy. Aren't you glad you came to church? I reckon one of the greatest things about joy is when you see it in somebody else that you love. Many of you will know my little girl Anita. She's 6 and a half now, would you believe? But my son Amos is about to turn 2. And for obvious reasons, you might not know him very well. He knows nothing of the outside world much in the pandemic era because it's been most of his life. And I think he's a bit more inhibited than his sister. But he absolutely idolises her. He loves her. When I pick him up from nursery, he's vaguely interested to see me. But straight away he says, "Anita, Anita!" That's who he wants. And the joy spreads across his face the moment he sets eyes on her. And I don't totally understand why, because she basically just manhandles him and wrestles him to the ground. But he thinks she is the greatest thing in the world. And we just love watching him. He knows nothing of the world's problems. His greatest suffering in his life is when he has to stop playing with trains to eat his dinner. But seeing him full of joy when he's pinned to the ground and tickled to death is amazing. Joy is infectious. The world needs more of it, especially at the moment. And we spend, I think, a lot of our time pursuing happiness. That's what our culture, I think, is directed towards. We're pursuing happiness, which often actually translates as comfort. But we really need joy. That inner experience of loving, of revelling in something, some great moment or some great satisfaction in something. A person we love enjoying themselves. And then it all comes out in a big smile. We just need more of that, don't we? Studies show that people who experience regular joy have less chance of having a heart attack, maintain a healthier blood pressure, tend to have lower cholesterol. Joy boosts our immune systems, fights stress and pain, improves our chances of living a longer life. It's brilliant. We need joy. We want it. But it's also under threat every single day, whether it's COVID or cancer or a crisis at home or whatever. Finding joy can be a challenge, and maybe you've struggled with that yourself. Maybe, whether you've been a follower of Jesus for ages, or you're just working out what you make of him, you're aware that moments of joy have been few and far between recently. I've got to say, I've felt that way myself. And you know, I can't complain. By any standard, I have a very nice life. But I found joy to be less present in this last year. I miss it. I want more of it back. But sometimes I think I need to reset where I'm looking to get joy, and maybe you do too. And that's the plan for today. We're going to look at one little passage, and it's one of those passages in the Bible when the first time you read it, it really doesn't sound that inspiring. It sounds like it's basically saying, be a disciplined person who pushes through difficult things. Seems about as joyful as a long flight on a budget airline. And this is in the book of James in the New Testament, and it's the first four verses. This is what James opens with. So let me read it, and I want to talk to you about the brilliant and maybe surprising things in this passage that are key to having joy, and why. And who wouldn't want more joy, eh? It says, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. There we have it. James is supposed to be a book of wisdom and how to live wisely if you follow Jesus. And let's face it, this first piece of wisdom sounds like anything but. Consider it pure joy when you face trials of many kinds. Now, the trials mentioned here are meant to be a range of things. Poverty, sickness, injustice, grief. Basically the full buffet of all of the bad stuff. The stuff to avoid. Consider it pure joy. Now, as someone who can spend a weekend sulking when my football team don't win, this statement does not click with me straight away. I mean, it's easy to understand the value of a positive attitude, isn't it, when times are hard. When someone's struggling with health or money or relationships, anything else, it's normal for us to encourage a bit of good old-fashioned positive attitude in our attempts to be helpful, isn't it? We understand that, don't we? You know, when we say, keep going, it'll get better, have a stiff upper lip, keep pushing through. What we really believe about suffering is expressed by our words. suffering is simply something to be endured, a sort of big lingering inconvenience. And the trials of poverty, sickness, injustice and grief are things to just avoid at all costs, obviously. But James says, consider it pure joy. What are we meant to do with this? It doesn't sound like it makes sense, because what James suggests here is one of the weirdest things a person could possibly say to our modern Western culture. The suggestion that we might consider any sort of suffering a joy is absolutely wild to us, incomprehensible. Now, is James saying, make your life as deliberately miserable as possible in the hope of finding some sort of vague religious sense of happiness? No, that's not what he's saying. The author Tim Keller, through his excellent book, Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering, looks at the different ways that cultures throughout history have responded to suffering. Everybody suffers, of course, but different cultures understand the meaning of suffering in different ways, and that changes how people respond to it. And Keller points out that while most cultures have pretty clear ways of understanding suffering and pretty much all see it as having some sort of purpose, us modern Westerners do not. Suffering for us is just a sad fact of life. We have no meaning for it, no point to it. We just want to move on as soon as possible. And if the suffering is so great that you can't, well, tough. Unlucky for you. James comes from a completely different perspective. What he says about suffering is alien to us, but it's not insane. And it's not just because he was writing a long time ago. He gives us a reason. So let's walk through it. The first thing is, James expects that followers of Jesus will face trials, that difficult things will happen to Christians. Now think on that for a moment. James's view of how the world works does not say that Christians will avoid suffering. Some Christians throughout history have taught this and thought this, especially at the moment, but you won't find that in the Bible. No, James expects his readers, who are Christians, to encounter all of the exact same hardships as everybody else. What James says about suffering is not a change of circumstances, like a magical get you out of it. Everybody suffers. It's about a change of approach, a change of attitude to it. You will face trials, but the question is, how will you face them? The second thing to note is that James sees the various difficulties of life as tests of faith. Now, it's important to say these are not tests in the sense of God saying, well, show me you're worthy and demonstrate all your knowledge of the right answers. Show me you're a good enough Christian. It's not that. To understand the whole thing, we need to know what James means by faith. In our world, faith is often wrongly seen as believing in something with no good reason. It's some nice things you'd like to be true. But that isn't what faith means. At least it's not what James means when he uses the word. The Greek word pistis, which is often translated as faith, is a very personal word. It's less about agreeing with some facts and more about trusting a person. In this case, God, of course. Think of it more as allegiance. To be allegiant to something is to be committed to it or to somebody. And so the trials we face are allegiance tests. When we face poverty and sickness and injustice and grief, our personal allegiance to God is being tested because, of course, when you're broke, tired, abused or devastated, it's harder to have an ongoing trust relationship with an apparently loving God. Of course it's harder. Of course. And we can't be glib about this because really terrible things happen to people. Some of you will know that a number of years ago, I spent some time living in Israel, and the couple who led the organisation I was with there, Phil and Heidi, had a large family, 5 kids. But a few years previous to the time I was there, their daughter Abigail, who was 13, was on a bus home from school when a suicide bomber got on board and detonated a device. Abigail died immediately, and they never saw her again. Just imagine the suffering and devastation that shaped all the lives of that family. Now, Phil and Heidi are highly intelligent people. They know all the theological right answers. But when I met with Phil every few weeks in those days, he was in a constant battle to keep personally trusting the God he believed in. Amazingly, he still trusts God to this day. It wasn't an intellectual battle. It was a heart thing. And in James's view of reality, this is the key but very controversial thing, that a trust relationship with God is the absolute most important thing in a person's life. It's the point of life, in fact. Everything else comes underneath it. Everything is taken over by it. That may sound extreme, but if James is right, even our most terrible experiences of suffering can find meaning. They can serve a greater purpose. They can be part of a path to joy. The idea here is not that these trials determine whether or not you have faith, but whether they strengthen what's already there. But how is it that facing hard things has a purpose that might bring about joy? Well, the third thing to see in the passage is the testing of a person's faith is a type of character strengthening that produces perseverance or steadfastness or endurance. There's lots of nice words the Bible translators insert here which get at the same thing. And these are very admirable character qualities, aren't they? We admire great athletes who show a bit of enduring, steadfast perseverance as they train and compete. But how on earth is this an appropriate response to facing the annoyingly common difficulties of life? Of course, we'd all like to persevere through things and come out the other side a bit stronger. But is that really an insight? What's different about that? Well, in James's understanding, perseverance is not the end goal. It's an ingredient, but the thing James is after is something really unfashionable: maturity. Now, if you're under the age of 35, maturity might seem like a dirty word. Really? Isn't there more to life than maturity? Is that really the aim? This is a remarkable thing. Don't miss this. James is saying that for followers of Jesus, because remember it's them he's addressing, the trials of life, big and small, are not desirable at all, but they can be useful. He sees a context for suffering, a purpose, and this is incredibly liberating. All the trials, the hardships we experience can be placed inside a greater story that makes sense. Imagine your own suffering, physical, mental, emotional, whatever, with the view that it adds to you, that your character, your very self, is greater for it, that somehow suffering helps you learn to be in the story of God, where you're meant to be. Suffering still hurts, you would never invite it, but it has a purpose, a meaning, and that meaning is maturity. When James talks about maturity, he's still talking about pistis, about allegiance. He's still talking about an allegiance to God in a relationship. He doesn't mean maturity in some sort of stereotype of being really dull and making loads of sensible decisions around mortgages. Overall, James is saying, I think, something like this. If you handle suffering in the right way, it will help you be closer to God. It will do you the world of good. And that will bring you the joy you're really after. Now, that sounds interesting, maybe good in theory, doesn't it? But there's a big obvious question. How does this actually play out in real life? Can anyone really live like this? Can a person's perspective on the trials we all face really be changed for the better in real life? Can mine? When James wrote about this, he said, because you know, to his readers. He knew that they knew that this was true. James wrote to people who had already experienced being matured in faith through suffering. He was confident that they got it. Because you know. Well, that's the first century, we might say. What about the real world today? Is there really a connection between maturing as a follower of Jesus and working out how to know joy in the middle of suffering? How about in the middle of a pandemic? How about when you've been stuck indoors or you haven't seen your family or you're sick? Is this just nice theory? One of the most interesting books I've read through lockdown is called The Gravity of Joy by a lady called Angela Williams-Gorrell. And she's a Christian and an academic. And she was asked a few years ago to teach a course on the subject of joy at Yale University in America, as you do. And then just before she started, three members of her family died in the space of a couple of months. One was her dad, one was her nephew, who was still quite young, and it's a really miserable time for her. And so, of course, she struggles personally to find joy at a point when she's meant to be teaching about it, and the book is all about her working this through. And she summarises the issue she's battling with when she says, there'll be a day in each of our lives when the question, how does pain fit into a good life, is especially urgent. And the book then explores what it looks like to find joy whilst suffering. And there's not an easy answer, of course, but after lots of time thinking, researching, and helping run a Bible study in a women's prison, she says this: joy is often the result of discovering something or someone we love and giving ourselves over to it. Joy is what we feel when we imagine we are living out a story that matters. The more we sense this story is larger than ourselves, the more intense the joy. And what she finds is that she's still sad, obviously. She's still grieving. But there is joy that comes from knowing you are part of a bigger story beyond yourself, and that suffering tells you continuously to keep belonging to that story. The bigger the story, the greater the joy. And there is no bigger story than God's story, and it's worth giving yourself over to. That's the purpose of suffering, and that's how it can lead us to joy. It's not pursuing the short-term moment, the high, or the long-term comfortable life, the happiness. It's the joy that comes from being more absorbed by God's story, or put differently, in being more mature as a follower of Jesus. Let's look at James's words again. He says, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work, so that you may become mature and complete, not lacking anything. Let's not lose how radical, how counterintuitive this is. Nobody else is telling the world this. Where did James get all his ideas from? James grew up as a Jew in a world run by the Romans, but intellectually shaped by the Greeks. And so he was familiar with all sorts of ideas, and none of them sounded exactly like this. But he also grew up as the younger brother of the person he came to recognise as God, Jesus. I don't think James's strange views on how to approach suffering were based on reading weighty books or wistfully stroking his chin from some ivory tower. I think James just watched his brother. When Jesus was arrested and tortured and crucified, he knew it was coming. He spoke about it ahead of time. But there is no sense in which Jesus invited, enjoyed, or celebrated suffering. When he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, the night before he was crucified, it's very clear that on one level, Jesus did not want what was about to happen, because who would? And yet, Jesus went to the cross anyway. Jesus modelled that suffering could have meaning, it could have purpose. Jesus went to the cross to get us. That was the big picture. Jesus suffered for what was worth greater joy. He considered us so valuable, so worthwhile, that the physical and spiritual agony of the cross was judged to be worth it. And when someone loves you that much, you know that your pistis, your allegiance, is well placed in them. Their story is safe to join. And so everything James thinks about suffering, this upside down, topsy-turvy perspective he has on the trials of life, the whole way he sees the whole thing, it's all based on what Jesus did first. All based on Jesus. And so as I finish, let me ask, how is your joy at the moment? Has it been eroded by the last year? Was it eroding anyway? Have you had a perfectly comfortable time through the pandemic and yet still had a joy deficit? It may be time to let God change your perspective. It's possible to live through the trials of life, which are inevitable, and still find joy. And Jesus is the way there.